Well, they tried to get the game done in 9, but the Connecticut legislative session is going into extra innings. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. We're back at home plate today. And once again, I want to give a thanks to Professor Joe Alicastro and all the staff and students at the Sacred Heart University Media Exchange for their hard work producing yesterday's program. And also our thanks to all the guests who appeared on the program. But now back to work here. And today is our weekly news roundup. And today we're concentrating on Connecticut and the legislative session and what got done and what didn't get done. Ebong Udama is here. He's here in the studio with me. He's WSHU's chief political reporter. Dan Haar is on the phone with us. Dan is associate editor, reporter, columnist for Hearst Connecticut Media. And Sue Haig is also on the line. Sue covers the state capitol for the Associated Press. As always, my thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Sue.
Great to be here.
Oh, I should also mention, later on in the program, we're going to hear from Lenny Grimaldi. Lenny is the publisher, and he has the website Only in Bridgeport. And, Dan, we're going to be talking about something that's near and dear to your heart, casinos in Bridgeport.
Yes. We've been talking about this for 5 years. We'll keep talking.
Only 5 years?
I guess.
you will hear I recorded the conversation with Lenny a little bit earlier today. We'll be playing it back. And I've been in Connecticut now for 40 years. I was talking about it 40 years ago. So some things have not changed. But anyway, welcome all. Ebong, the session supposedly is done, but a special session is going to start. How much more needs to be done in Connecticut?
I don't know. I don't even think the legislature knows. The lawmakers don't know. They're still trying to figure out what they want to come back and do. Well, basically, what they did is that they passed a resolution to come back into special session to deal with school construction and bonding. And Governor Lamont wants them to come back and deal with transportation infrastructure funding. Pretty much tolls, highway tolls. So they're still going to work that out in the next few weeks. The governor says he's going to be meeting with legislative leaders. He wants everyone to be involved, and we'll see how that pans out. But we don't know when they'll be coming back because it's still being discussed right now. Basically, here's what Speaker Arasimowicz had to say about... Let's not deal with the tolls yet.
Right. Let's go to Mr. Ritter.
Yes. Let's deal with the budget because right. That's what they're proudest of, that they were able to get a $43 billion 2-year budget passed on time for the first time in quite a while. I mean, the last time 2 years ago, it took until I believe almost November before we got a budget. And it was supposed to be done before the new fiscal year began in June of that year. So they're very proud of it. And they have been also, the Democrats say they've closed a roughly $3.5 billion 2-year budget hole. And this is how Majority Leader Matt Ritter, this is how he described the problem they faced this year and how they solved it.
There were two looming issues that would keep me up at night. The first one was the teacher pensions, right? That balloon would make you think twice about relocating or expanding here. Because when you read the prospectus, when we sell our bonds, you go, "Eh, I don't know about that. How are they going to deal with that?" That would swallow up 20% of the whole annual revenue of one budget. We found a way to do it. We found a way to do it also by taking $380 million that we didn't spend that will also go to the rainy day fund. So when I say the rainy day fund is $2 billion, it's actually $2.4 billion when you count that, and it could be as high as $3 billion when we get through the biennium. And then the second part, the hospitals, another $2, $3 billion, and one of our largest employers. So you get those two big things off the plate. You have that stability, and you have a $3 billion rainy day fund. That is so different than 10 years ago when you had $0 in a rainy day fund. You had these looming liabilities. That would scare me.
Dan Haar, when you hear these numbers, how do they sit with you?
Well, sorry about the delay there. I was on mute while I was listening. first of all, it's a myth to say that we ever had a $3.7 billion shortfall. And so, because, for example, everyone knew that the hospital tax, which we're not going to take the time to explain here, suffice it to say, it gains the state $500 million. Everyone knew it was going to continue. The only reason it was part of the deficit was because it was scheduled to sunset. It wasn't a possibility that we weren't going to continue that. It's basically a scheme or a ploy or whatever negative word you want to use to say that it uses Medicaid dollars to augment the budget by giving it to the hospitals, taxing the hospitals and then giving them back Medicaid dollars, which are subsidized. So you can take $1 billion right away off this, because that's 500 times 2 years, off of the deficit. And you also had growth in, not growth in the economy, but growth in the projection just between November and April, 5 months. Is that 5 or 6? 6 months. 5 months. You saw basically a $600 million gain in the amount of money that we projected the economy would generate in Connecticut, right? So now you multiply that times two, and that's another billion. So you're really, you know, I guess that $1 billion is still a lot of money, but it's an utter myth that the deficit was ever $3.7 billion. That said, they did a great job of plugging the $1 billion deficit without increasing income tax rates, and that was a very big dispute because the liberals in the House really, really, really wanted to see either a surcharge on capital gains or a rise in the highest rate of income tax for the highest earners.
Sue Haig, if I could just ask you about this special session, because if someone is listening to this program right now and they're thinking, okay, it sounds like they're done. Why is a special session being called?
Well, there's just some of these issues are just so big. I think there actually there's a possibility there could be four different special sessions. A lot of times it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody is going to be coming up there and spending days on end in Hartford. It's probably just going to affect a small number of people, like the people that are focused on tolls. They'll be trying to work on something behind the scenes after spending months of working behind the scenes trying to get a deal on this. And then they'll probably call people back up. So it looks like for a vote. So it looks like we might have a special session to deal with the bonding bills that Ebong mentioned. And then there'll probably be a veto session if Lamont actually does veto anything and they want to try to override it. Then you've got the tolls issue. If they do come up with a deal, there's a possibility that if by some miracle they come up with some sort of wide-ranging gambling bill that could involve a Bridgeport casino, it could involve sports betting, internet gaming, there could be a special session for that. And then the hospital deal that Dan mentioned, that Lamont has a tentative agreement with the hospitals to settle a longstanding lawsuit with the hospitals over that complicated tax. If that actually gets ratified by all the hospitals, and I'm being told that might not happen until the fall, then they're going to have to call lawmakers back to Hartford to vote on that as well. And then in the meantime, you know, this happens every year. People get disappointed, become disappointed that some big bill that they were pushing didn't make it. One of those has to do with a big election reform bill that the Secretary of the State wanted. And it includes everything from trying to fix the system for same-day voter registration. It also deals with felons and their voting rights. That didn't make it. She wants them to do a redo. And then there's this public health insurance option bill that got watered down, and then that ultimately that didn't pass either. And there's some people that want to do that, but I wouldn't be optimistic that they'll have a special session on those bills because they get nervous about that. They don't want everybody and their brother trying to resurrect bills that didn't make it during the regular session.
Majority Leader Ritter, Matt Ritter, from Hartford said that really they're full-time legislature. they pretend to be part-time.
Dan, I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking that you guys won't be able to take a summer vacation.
No, actually, I'm very much looking forward to the fact that in every two-year cycle, there are 6 months in which there is neither a legislative session nor an election. So when you think about it, June to December of the odd numbered years is that quiet 6 months. And I'm very much counting on that. And I think that with the one caveat that I'm about to give, I'm in agreement with Sue Haig that there's not going to be a lot of sturm and drang over these special sessions. I don't believe that we're going to be looking at any progress on casinos until next year, which is unfortunate. And I don't think there's going to be much agreement on I don't think that these election reforms are going to be the subject of a special session either. But one thing that is coming up over the summer is economic development, because Lamont has a system in his head, along with David Layman, the economic development commissioner. They have a system in their head which they've described. They want to do less of these sort of individual deals, and they want to do something else. And what that something else is, we don't know exactly, but it has to go through legislation. And they may want to do that before the start of the year in January.
Okay.
So generally, I'm looking for a quiet period. I don't think we're going to be overly taxed.
The special session is going to come up, what, this summer, where the legislators will be dealing with the tolls, Zeibang?
Basically, that's what the governor would like. He's definitely wants them back to talk about tolls, and it's not really clear where the lawmakers are as far as tolls are concerned. Here's how Speaker Arasimowicz described his caucus and whether they have the votes for tolls.
As far as the 76 votes for tolling, we have that. What we don't have is the 76 votes for a tolling plan that is a plan that the Senate feels comfortable with and that would eventually get the governor's signature. So it really depends what that plan is moving forward.
Dan Haar, what are your thoughts as to whether or not tolling will go forward?
There should be a special session. There will be a special session on tolling. The governor has a lot of levers to pull. Even with the so-called debt diet, he still has parks and open space and schools that he can use to buy those three votes that are on the fence in the Senate. I think that tolls is made unnecessarily complicated. People keep saying, I want to see the details. The reality is we know the details. 4.7 to 5.3 cents per mile on average, a whole bunch of gantries, because we've got the number of gantries is completely irrelevant. It's a big fat red herring of an issue because we've got lots of on and off in our highways. It's not like the Mass Pike where you have, 15 exits. And so it's really not that complicated an issue. We know how to make it work. Other states have done it. And that complication is just used as a crutch. There are three people in the Senate who are sitting on the fence. Their votes are being bought and paid for as we speak, and that should happen, but it's not as easy as it sounds to make it happen.
You know what's interesting about this is that the governor keeps talking about reaching out to Republicans, and I don't see much movement there. So maybe that's a takeaway from the fact that he's got to get his own Democrats online.
Yeah, when I said three votes in the Senate, I meant three Democrats that are sitting on the fence. There are at least two or three Democrats that are hard-nosed. Senator May Flexer and Senator Julie Kushner are absolute no's, and I believe Senator Maroney, Sue may be able to correct me on that. I believe those are absolute no's, and that's why the ones that are on the fence are necessary, because there are 22 Democratic senators, and you need 18 votes.
Sue?
I would be surprised if perhaps there may be some changes to the working draft that Lamont put out last month. To try to appease some of those Democratic senators that aren't keen on tolls. Matt Ritter yesterday raised the possibility of, hey, why don't we just toll bridges? And, so there would be fewer gantries, even though I know what you're saying, that it doesn't mean a lot, but to the average person, 50 tolling gantries sounds like a lot. And to have them on that meant on 84, 91, 95, and Route 15, it kind of freaks people out. Some people are looking at a lot of money every month. So I'm thinking there may be some effort to try to tweak this in a way that will somehow generate this $800 million in revenue that they're looking for. And I wouldn't be don't be surprised if maybe it will be a little bit different than what they've been talking about for the last couple months.
Sue, while I have you, we know that the efforts to legalize recreational marijuana did not make it. What are they talking about for the future?
This is kind of complicated, too. There is talk of trying to have, we don't have initiative and referenda here in Connecticut, but they're talking about trying to have a vote. Other states have done this, having the voters decide whether or not they want to go ahead with it. So they're talking about maybe putting something on either the 2020 ballot or the 2022 ballot, depending on, and it would be to change the state's constitution to somehow allow marijuana legalization. And the year difference depends on how wide of a margin it passes in both chambers. Matt Ritter expressed sort of frustration yesterday of not being able to get this through the legislature. And so now they really want to get guidance from the voters to see where they stand on it.
Dan?
Well, there's no question the voters are going to pass it. Unfortunately, Connecticut only has a constitutional amendment. We don't have a referendum, as Sue said. And so that's going to make it harder to structure because, as one reporter, Mark Pazniokas, said yesterday in one of the scrums, what are you going to do? Change the constitution that says you can smoke marijuana? It's not so easy. It's not a resolution the way Colorado, California, and Massachusetts had, where they're governed that way. I think, to be clear here, there are no Republican votes for legalization. There were two Republican votes that I was able to identify in the House that would have voted for it if it were a grow-your-own bill. But absent grow-your-own, they don't want that. And I think it's unfortunate for the side of legalization that what happened was Democratic votes from the cities evaporated because of the black pastors who made such a big issue of it, seeing addiction in those communities and persuaded enough of the urban Democrat legislators to pull their support. I think that we can do it through a referendum constitutional method, but I don't see that happening in the next because you need a super majority to get the next year's vote. So it would be a 2022. It would go into effect. We'd be buying it in Connecticut in around 2025.
Well, talking about making things even more complicated than they are, it was interesting to see how this unfolded through the session, how it seemed to gather a lot of steam and then it fizzled out towards the end of the session and totally disappeared by the end of the session. It was, and a lot of things happened that way this session.
By the end, it went up in smoke. Okay.
It got tied up too into all these other issues like expungement of criminal records and things like that. It was became a very, very complicated bill.
Dan, I'm going to ask you to run down two issues for us now: minimum wage and paid family and medical leave.
Minimum wage, we see the 10-10 minimum wage go up October 1st to $11 an hour. We see once a year or so $1 increase from the 11 for 4 years until June 1st of 2023, or is it July 1st of 2023 when we reach the $15 at about the same rate as Massachusetts and I think Washington. So it puts us pretty much in the vanguard along with a couple of other states. The big question is whether that attracts workers or makes businesses go away. My tendency is to think that the minimum wage is not quite as huge an issue one way or another as we think, although that view is in the minority. Paid family and medical leave is a $400 tax on a family household, which makes $80,000 a year. It's one half of 1%. We need to stop talking about that as anything other than a tax. I think it's a fine idea. I wrote a column that said it would be better to do it on a year when we didn't have other tax increases. But, it is what it is. It's an insurance program. It's going to give people the opportunity to get up to 12 weeks off, paid, albeit at a typically lower rate than they may have made, depending on their pay, right? It's going to cap out at a weekly wage that's not quite as good. And the big thing, the big compromise in this was that as it stands now, as it passed, if it comes up short, they're going to limit the use of the benefit rather than raise the tax, rather than raise the what do you call it, the banana, the fee, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that was a big deal because in earlier versions of the legislation, what it said was if too many people qualify and take that paid leave, we're going to have the right to raise the assessment. And that was a I think that may have led to its passage. It may have passed otherwise, but that was certainly one thing. And one more quickly, one more rankling issue in that is that the people taking the paid leave in order to care for a loved one, that loved one does not have to be a blood relative or a relative. It can be a friend. And that's something that the Republicans had a lot of concern about. Overall, those things are very, very hard to tell what they're going to do to the business climate. My suspicion is not as big a deal either way. It's not going to be a panacea nor the death knell of the Connecticut economy.
But the Democrats will be able to say that they did something this year. And that's one of the things they did was the three things is passing the budget on time, minimum wage increase, and paid family and medical leave.
Sue, a question for you. Go ahead.
Sure. I was just going to say it's worth noting after 2023, there's still the potential for more minimum wage increases.
That's just what I was going to ask you. So it can potentially go up from $15 an hour.
But then the lawmakers wouldn't be involved.
Employment cost index.
It's just the cost index, and so it would go up automatically, and this wouldn't require a vote by any legislators.
That was a big fight by Democrats because they get tired of doing this fight every year or so.
Dan?
If you want to get really wonky for a minute here, it goes up consonant with the employment cost index, which is the total average additional cost that it takes to employ a person, rather than the CPI, the consumer price index. And the employment cost index is typically higher, sometimes significantly higher than the CPI. So over time, we will have the highest minimum wage in the country.
Of course, we like wonky. We're an NPR affiliate, so that is our middle name over here. So we're good with that. Ethan's Law, Ghost Gun, Sue.
Ethan's Law was very bipartisan. I'm sure you know this stems from a very sad case where a young man accidentally shot himself with a friend's father's gun. So what this does is it makes sure that anybody that has an unloaded weapon as well as a loaded weapon has to have it stored securely. In the case of this poor kid, the gun was unloaded, but it was near some ammunition, and they were able to load the gun. His parents have been at the Capitol for most of these big votes, and now they're trying to replicate this down in Washington. The ghost guns bill that passed, that was less of a bipartisan bill. There's questions whether or not it really is an issue, but this would ban these 3D untraceable guns. There was another one, too, that if you leave that passed, that Lamont signed, if you have a gun that you want to keep in your car and you leave your car, you have to have the gun secured in a locked glove box and a safe or in a locked trunk. Because there's concern that people might see your 45 sitting on the passenger side seat, I don't know, and people are breaking in and stealing guns. So all three of those passed. That's probably some of the biggest gun changes we've had in a while.
Hey, Bong, can we see more gun control legislation coming up in the next session, or will this be it for a few years, you think?
I don't see it right now, but who knows what's going to happen, because it seems to be that it's what happens. What happens in the public is what generates this. When we have mass shootings or when we have the situation with the teenager in Guilford, those are the types of things that actually stimulate action from the legislature. Outside of that, I don't see any gun legislation coming up next year.
Dan Hart, can I get your opinion, your thoughts about as to how this legislative session went? Your colleague Ken Dixon was with us the other weekend, and he said, look, they seem to have trouble figuring this out, trying to figure out how the process works. And some have said, well, they're rookies at it. What's your opinion?
Well, I made the comment in our newsletter yesterday, not to plug our newsletter here, that it was D-Day and that the governor rightly recognized it as D-Day. And I made the comment that whatever else we can say about the greatest generation and the World War II era, legislators certainly didn't stand for the sort of uprising by freshman lawmakers that we see today. And so some of what happened precisely because of the power that everybody seems to have equally. Being there for 20 years doesn't seem to matter as much as it did even just a few years ago when, Richard Tulisano ruled the Judiciary Committee with whatever cliche you want to use, an iron fist. And likewise, Bill Dyson on appropriations. It doesn't work that way anymore. And so that causes some of the sort of consternation and what I would give an incomplete grade to the whole system because of all the work that's not done yet. You have to kind of give it an incomplete, and you also give it an incomplete because we just simply don't know what's going to be the effect of the family and medical leave benefit.
Right.
You know something, Dan? We have a clip here of Lamont trying to give his own assessment of how the first 6 months in Hartford have been for him. And here's Lamont.
I see a problem and I want to solve it. And sometimes I'm in a bit of a rush. And this place, I've never heard the phrase, it's a talker. It's a talker. Sometimes people don't want to make a decision and they want to talk it to death, or they want to study it to death, or they want to avoid a tough decision. And that's not the world I come from. And frankly, you know, when I ran as somebody who comes from a very different background than what you're used to around here. And I ran as somebody who started up a business and created jobs. And I ran as somebody who's going to have the mind of a small business person when it comes to solving problems. So we're getting to know each other. It's a building that's based on relationships. I didn't know everybody when I got up here. Susan knew a few more people than I did. And I think we've got good relationships. And the door is open and we're going to be working together.
So, Sue, are they playing well together in the sandbox?
Well, he's definitely getting along better with the Democrats than he is with the Republicans. I think if you talk to some lawmakers off the record, they'll say that they, you know, he says things aren't moving fast enough for him. I've heard complaints that, you know, stuff wasn't ready. You know, a lot of things, some homework hadn't been done yet. I think that the Republicans feel very left out of this session. The Democrats really took advantage of their larger majorities in the House and Senate. You know, the last 2 years they've had to deal with a tie in the Senate, and that forced them to do things in a more bipartisan way. Hence, the last two budgets were bipartisan budgets. And the Republicans, in the beginning, they liked the fact that Malloy was a businessman. They liked the fact that he said he had this open door policy. But then when you talk to Len Pisano, the Senate Republican leader, he's disappointed. He says, yeah, the door is open, but, you know, the governor's not really listening to us. And I think that they feel sort of burned in a way. It'll be interesting to see whether or not Lamont will try to reach out to them, as he said yesterday he's going to on tolls, and see whether or not he can sort of do a little bit of repair work over the summer.
Okay, Sue, I'm going to ask you to hold on for just a moment. We're going to call in one more guest to the program. Lenny Grimaldi is the owner and publisher of Only in Bridgeport, a website that is, what else, all about Bridgeport. We're bringing Lenny on for a few minutes to talk about Bridgeport and the effort to get a casino in the city. Hi, Lenny.
How you doing, Ron?
I'm well,
great,
thank
you. Great to catch up again.
It's great to catch up again after many, many years.
Decades.
Decades.
See, we've been at this for decades.
this is speaking of that, this is not a new story for Bridgeport. Right. How long has this been going on?
A casino for Bridgeport?
Yes.
For decades.
I think when I came to Connecticut, which was about four decades back, I remember them talking about getting a casino in Bridgeport back then. So, I mean, we're talking 30, 40 years.
Well, it reached its apex in the mid-90s, 94, 95. You know, this is a couple of years after the state signed the gaming compact with the tribal nations that run Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods. Mm-hmm. And gaming in Connecticut, it can be very, very complicated because of that compact, which calls for the tribes to provide 25% of the slot take in exchange for gaming exclusivity. Effectively, it's a monopoly.
And this started back with then-Governor Weicker.
Correct. And so 92 or 93, he signs this compact first with the operators of Foxwoods and then extended on to Mohegan Sun. So the tribe's position in Connecticut is that we have exclusivity no matter what. And so, you know, the latest wrinkle.
Right. When you say no matter what, you mean no matter what form of gambling.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. That's their position. Some others who are gaming partners in the state, like Sportech, which operates all of the OTB outlets, mm-hmm. there's 17 in the state of Connecticut, they're saying, hey, we're a gaming partner too. So you don't have exclusivity to that. This all has to be negotiated. And that's kind of the latest wrinkle of what's going on with gaming, expanded gaming for Connecticut and a potential casino for Bridgeport. The latest is this. If there's going to be a casino in Bridgeport, the tribes have to be part of the solution. But you know what has been proposed is not exactly overwhelming Governor Lamont. Mm-hmm. So this is not going to get to first base without Lamont on board. And effectively, what Lamont is saying, the latest proposal by the tribes for Bridgeport is half-baked. They're going to have to come up with a stronger economic development plan if it's going to work. So long story short, MGM has been kind of a driving force for a casino in Bridgeport. A couple of years ago, they proposed a $675 million development along Bridgeport's waterfront. It's a beautiful prime piece of real estate. Bridgeport, by the way, is recapturing its waterfront mm-hmm. along Steel Point. It's outstanding what's going on over there. People should check it out. So they proposed this really incredibly large development for Bridgeport. A lot of people bought into it. But again, the tribe said, well, it's not going to go anywhere because we have gaming exclusivity. MGM said, open up the process, see what the best offer comes back for Bridgeport. If we're selected, the revenue we're going to generate for the state is going to outweigh the gaming dollars you already get from the tribes. That's the back and forth, right? The tribes are saying now, we want to do something in Bridgeport, but on a much smaller scale, like a couple of $100 million, but they also want a public subsidy. Whereas MGM did not want a public subsidy. You're saying, hey, we're suited up. We're ready to go. We don't want any tax breaks. Tribes want a public subsidy.
How much?
The latest is upwards of $100 million.
Is that just from the city or from the
That's
state?
Probably state. No, that would be from that. That would be a local and state partnership. Mm. So Lamont is saying, hey, I'm not in the position to do that. I don't want to do that.
They're trying to cut the budget in Hartford. They're not willing to spend $100 million
they
at
have,
this point.
Yeah, and they have a budget now. It passed a couple of days ago in this latest session, which was a long, drawn-out session.
Right.
So what could potentially happen is there could be a special session. There will be one, according to Lamont, on tolls.
On tolls.
The question is, will sports betting, gaming be a part of it? It's an open question. Someone's going to have to do a very good sales pitch to Lamont to say, hey, let's have a special session on this as well.
Okay, with the 5 minutes that we have left, what happened with the negotiations with MGM? Did they even know that Bridgeport was talking with the tribes?
Yes, they know. They definitely know that. Lamont made a pass earlier this year at trying to bring all the parties together. They were talking about a global agreement, not an easy thing to do with. Lamont was talking to MGM, he was talking to tribes, let's get together, let's make a marriage and do something together. The tribe's position was, we hold all the cards. We have gaming exclusivity, right? And so they feel like they don't have to cut a deal with anybody. The problem is someone's going to file a lawsuit in this sort. So, you know, MGM's claiming antitrust because the tribes, in response to MGM Springfield, Massachusetts facility, mm-hmm. Lobbied the state of Connecticut to allow them to build a facility in East Windsor to try to counter and protect that market. But they want to build it on non-tribal land. Mm. So that throws a whole new legal wrinkle potentially into this gaming compact. The gaming compact clearly is for the tribes to build on tribal land. But this new piece for East Windsor is not on tribal land. Same thing in Bridgeport.
Right.
We're not talking about tribal land. So, you know, whether it's going to be MGM or whether it's going to be Sport Tech, which also, you know, has skin in the game as a gaming operator in the state of Connecticut, if there's no, like, grand resolution to this thing, someone's going to file a lawsuit, which means it's just going to be tied up in court for years.
So if anything happens, we're not going to actually see a casino in Bridgeport, you figure, for what, 3-5 years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. If even if something is approved, again, if there was a scenario where, you know, a grand, you know, global resolution could mm-hmm. take place between all the parties involved, yeah, then you'd see it happen. But short of that, I just don't see this thing happening, not based on what's the latest offer.
So here's my question: what I'm trying to understand, why Bridgeport nowadays? Because I'm hearing that the casinos in Yonkers are being upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
There's talk in Albany about putting casinos, full-fledged casinos, either in New York City or around New mm-hmm. York City. Would a casino in Bridgeport still make sense?
MGM has said the last best location is Bridgeport because of its proximity.
Proximity to New York City.
To New York City and Fairfield County.
Okay.
You got the highest discretionary income in the United States in Fairfield County. So that's why, and a beautiful waterfront parcel. We're talking about on the east side of Bridgeport, across the street from the Bass Pro Shops there. The city has reclaimed its waterfront with a new marina, a new oyster bar, and it just opened. It's fabulous views, so people should check that out. That is a beautiful piece of real estate that MGM wants to do it there, and so the tribes. MGM owns Yonkers now, so they're eventually going to build that out.
Mm-hmm.
And once they do that, where's Fairfield County going to go? So the tribes may be saying, you know what, maybe Bridgeport makes sense for us, because if MGM builds out Yonkers, that Fairfield County audience that comes up to see us in Eastern Connecticut.
They used to travel to the eastern part of the state, which they won't go there anymore.
Which is an hour and 15 minutes to 90 minutes, 75 to 90 minutes, versus maybe some areas, half an hour,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think that's part of the equation. But again, sports for the tribes will build something in Bridgeport provided they have the sports betting piece. So what's that all about? Last year, the Supreme Court of the United States declared that states can legally have an online gaming operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's big money in that.
Rhode Island is doing it. New Jersey is doing it.
Right. And Sport Tech wants that too. The other gaming partner for the state, which operates the OTBs. They say, we're suited up. We're ready to go. We can roll this thing out right away. So that sports betting piece has to be resolved. It hasn't been yet. Who's gonna operate it? How is it gonna be implemented? So that, you know, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, however that shakes out. So that piece has to be resolved.
We may be talking about this 30, 40 years from now.
Now that I confused everybody, right?
Lenny Grimaldi, only in Bridgeport. It's online, and you could see it at any time. Lenny, thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Full Story on WSHU. We're back live with Eban Gudama, Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, Sue Haig, AP reporter, covers the state capitol. Dan, you wrote a column about this the other day. Your thoughts about casinos in Bridgeport.
Lenny is being polite, family radio show. That's one of the stupidest ploys I've ever seen in 30 years of doing this. The idea that they thought they could dupe Mayor Ganim and some, but not all, members of the Bridgeport legislative delegation to fight for and support this deal that offers absolutely nothing whatsoever to the city and state is breathtakingly amazing to me. The tribes don't want to build in Bridgeport because they're hemmed in on the north after Wynn Resorts opens the $2 billion facility in Everett, Mass. Near Boston. They also have, of course, the Rhode Island smaller casinos. They're hemmed in to the northwest up Route 2 toward Hartford because MGM, and if they ever get to build East Windsor of their own, will take care of that market. So they need Fairfield, New Haven counties, and New York to come to the casinos. They're bigger. They're a little bit more sort of resorty, and that's their big draw. They need that. They don't need to build in Bridgeport right now. Nobody wants to build in Bridgeport. MGM has, just to pick up on what Lenny was saying, They pay a 60% tax, not 16, 60, 60, 60% tax in Yonkers at Empire Casino. So they may have a little bit more of an incentive to build in Bridgeport to serve the market here, which is why they put it at two-thirds the size of MGM Springfield, not a full-size resort. And that would transform the city. So that's really the perfect size politically, that $675 million versus the $350 million that the tribes were proposing, which really is $250 million because the $100 million from the city and state is infrastructure that doesn't go into a casino and a hotel. There are other legal problems that we don't need to go into with this. That's just an incredibly dumb idea. And the bottom line is, unless the governor can get the tribes to drop East Windsor, and in that scenario, MGM agrees to walk away without suing, there isn't going to be a deal and there isn't going to be legislation.
You know something, the bottom line is that the legislature has to vote on this. And I don't see the Connecticut legislature voting for a non-tribal casino. I don't see it happening. That's the problem they had it with East Windsor, and it was only when they had it as solely a tribal casino would they vote for that. And even that is mired. I don't see it going anywhere. So it's a lot of energy, but very little action on casinos.
Ebong, you also recently spoke with Len Fasano, didn't you?
I spoke during the 2016 campaign for president. I spoke with Lenny Grimaldi about Donald Trump's business interest in Bridgeport, and at that time, Ron Wynn was trying to set up a casino in Bridgeport. They had a referendum that they did, and it passed. The people of Bridgeport voted to have a casino. And at that time, Donald Trump was in trouble in Atlantic City, and he certainly did not want to have a Wynn casino in Bridgeport. So he came up with some scheme and bought a piece of property that is now the ballpark that no longer exists in Bridgeport.
I appreciated that, but in the meantime, I was trying to lead you into Len Fasano.
Len Fasano. I thought you were talking about Lenny Grimaldi.
Two Lens.
Well, as far as Len Fasano is concerned, you know, at the beginning of the session, it seemed as if they were going to give Governor Lamont the benefit of the doubt. At the end of the session, right after Lamont gave his speech to the General Assembly, shortly after midnight, after the session ended, I spoke with Len Fasano, and this was his response to the governor's touting of getting a budget passed on time.
I think we did some good legislation bipartisanly. I think we did a good job in many cases. But, you know, the budget's the heart and soul. It's the social services. It's government doing what it has to do so people can survive who need help. And I think we failed in that regard. And I think we failed in having a balanced one.
Well, that's the way Lenny Grimaldi. I'm still going back. I'm still thinking of.
You're
Lenny.
Still thinking of Lenny Grimaldi, Len who
Fasano,
you've known for many
Len
years.
Len Fasano. That was his take on what the session was this year.
Sue, hey, can I ask you if you had to give a grade? If you were a school teacher, what would you give the legislature?
Oh, I'm not going to grade anybody.
All right.
I think from the Democrats' perspective, they. I'm sure feel that they got an A. They got some major things through that they wanted for a long time. The paid family medical leave, the minimum wage, and also, you know, they point to having $2 billion in the rainy day fund, which is a big deal. And they also see as a major success dealing with the teacher's retirement pension fund, spreading out those payments so we don't have this massive cliff. And the Republicans, talking to them, I'm sure they would grade it a D maybe, because there's stuff in there that they do like, of course. But, you know, you just heard Len Fasano say the budget's out of balance. He's saying, you know, it relies on some union savings that haven't been reached yet, and they say that it's a total change in direction from the bipartisan budget.
Dan, with the 1 minute that we have left, any grades to be given here? Any good grades?
I give an incomplete. I give a B if you have to grade what's been done so far. I would point out that Senator Witkoski, the number two Republican in the Senate, gave a B to the session on business legislation, which matters, other than the budget. And with the budget, a C. Themis Claridis, the Republican leader in the House, gave it a D. I had to talk her up from an F because of the lack of tax increase. So the bottom line is it's a mixed picture for everybody, and the question is where it is mixed on the scale.
And Abog, you're going to get the final word today, Professor.
I'm not giving a grade, but I would say this about Governor Lamont. He was able to hold the line on taxing millionaires. So he really did not want to see any type of income tax increase, and he got his way.
Abong Udama, WSHU's chief political reporter, Dan Haar. Dan, always a pleasure to speak with you. Associate editor, reporter, columnist for Hearst Connecticut Media, Sue Haig. And Sue covers the state capitol for the Associated Press. My thanks to all of you. I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Great to be here. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Sue. Also, I'd like to thank Lenny Grimaldi. And the website is only in Bridgeport. And Lenny will be back with us in the future to talk about the Bridgeport casinos. That is going to do it for our show today. Joelle Schrock is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.